any further ado, let me introduce the 38th Chief of Staff of the Army, General Ray O'Dearden. Sir.
Thank you. Thank you. Everybody sit down, please. Great to see you. How y'all doing today? It's great to be out here at Fort Riley. It's nice to be in the warm weather, but I'm told it wasn't warm a few days ago, I guess, huh? Well, I wanted to just spend a few minutes having the opportunity to talk to you about what's going on in the Army, and then have the opportunity for you to ask me questions. And I really want you to ask me questions, and they can be hard questions, and I'll attempt to answer them. But it's important we have this dialogue, especially during these difficult times that we're going through. But first, obviously, I want to thank General Mayville and his wife, Shan, for welcoming us here to Fort Riley. It's always great coming out here, and this remains, obviously, one of the busiest installations and busiest divisions that we have in the Army. The headquarters just redeployed from Afghanistan. I just got off and did a briefing in a VTC with 2nd Brigade, with the commanders in Djibouti, really starting to be the test bed of us executing regionally aligned forces with Africa. It was really a good session, and I look forward to that. We have 3rd Brigade of the 1st IBC out of Fort Knox, who's going to deploy this summer. 4th Brigade of 1st IBCT just redeployed in February from OIF. I had a chance to visit them there before they came back, and it's great to see them now back home with their families. 1st Sustainment Brigade headquarters is currently deployed. I know the Aviation Brigade is preparing to deploy here in the next couple months, next month or so. So this remains a very, very busy place. So I want to take about 10-15 minutes just to kind of talk about how I see what's going on in the Army. I always start out by saying, as I stand here today, the Army has about 80,000 soldiers deployed. We have about 56,000 or so deployed to Afghanistan. We have another 12,000 deployed to Kuwait. We have soldiers deployed to Turkey. We have soldiers deployed to Jordan. We have soldiers deployed to UAE. We have soldiers deployed to other places in the Middle East. We also have 90,000 soldiers forward stationed, to include over 20,000 in Korea, 28,000 in Europe, and many other places in the world in 150 different countries. The reason I start out with that is that our Army remains very engaged in our national security infrastructure and what we're trying to achieve in order to sustain our security of this nation. And sometimes I think we forget about that, but it's important for us to never forget that. And I know you know it better than anybody here at Fort Riley because of the deployments that have been executed right from here. I think, as many of you know, we're going through a time of some significant budget problems, especially here in 13, where several things happened that caused us to be short what we call operations and maintenance funds for the last 6 months of the year. First was we had a mismatch between the fact that Congress didn't pass a budget. We had a continuing resolution. We had a mismatch of funds, which left us about $6 billion short. They've since corrected that with further legislation. But we're still short about $6 billion because of sequestration. And we're short about $7.8 billion to pay our bills in Afghanistan. So we've had to take about $13 billion out of the Army budget in the last 6 months to pay for sequestration and continue to pay for the war fight in Afghanistan. And so what that's done is that's caused us to take some drastic actions in the Army over the last 6 months. For example, we've had to furlough civilians, and I believe the Secretary of Defense just announced about a half hour ago that, in fact, we're going to furlough civilians for 11 days. It started at 21. We got it to 14. We got it down to 11. We wanted to get it to zero, but we weren't able to do that. We've had to cancel 7 combat training center rotations, which directly impacts the readiness of our units. We've had to cancel flying hours. We've had to reduce our ability to reset equipment, which has put some pressure on our depots and some pressures on our sustainment. So these are concerns because these are readiness concerns. And obviously, we want to maintain a high level of readiness. My concern is this could continue into 14, depending on what we get out of Congress, who is going to start debating the 14 budget here in about a month or so. And right now, we have four different versions of a budget. We have the President's version, the House version, the Senate version. And if they can't come to an agreement, then they execute sequestration, which is the worst version of all, which requires us to have more cuts. So that's kind of what we're facing. Now, what I tell everybody as I go around here at Fort Riley, I really don't want you all to worry about that. You let me worry about that, but I want to just inform you it's a problem. I just need you to stay focused on what you do every day, to train, to sustain your equipment, to develop leaders, to take care of our families, and do the best you can with the resources that we give you. And we can talk about that if you want to ask me some specific questions about that. So I want to take a minute to kind of talk about what's the future. I think we've already announced that the Army is going to reduce its size, the active component Army, from 570 to 490,000. As I stand here today, we are about at 535,000. We've been able to do it over the last 2 years. We've been able to do it through mostly natural attrition. We've had to do some boards, but we're on the right glide path to get to 490,000 by the end of 17, which means we'll reduce the size of the Army a bit, we'll reduce the number of brigade combat teams and some other structure, but I believe with that end strength that we have the capacity and capability to do what we're going to be asked to do, and we'll be able to sustain a level of readiness that's necessary. If we get additional cuts, it will require us to take out more end strength, and it could affect our readiness and modernization. Then I have some concerns as we move forward. But we'll come to that if we have to later on. As I look to the future, there's a couple things that I would just kind of highlight of where we're headed with the Army. And there's one sentence that I would just use that I think is important. Globally responsive and regionally engaged, and I'm going to explain that. Globally responsive means that we have the ability to deploy our forces anywhere in the world on short notice, but we're able to tailor and scale our units and our organizations to meet whatever the need would be. So we're looking at much smaller deployments, if necessary. And these deployments might not be operational deployments. They could be deployments to do building partner capacity, doing exercises, doing additional training with other nations. But that's the kind of force that we're looking to in the future, force that's adaptable, that's agile, that's flexible to meet a wide variety of missions. Throughout time, the Army has been given one major mission, that's to win our nation's wars. We're not going to walk away from that. But it's no longer enough. We have to do more. So we have to be able to shape the other areas around the world and prevent conflict so we don't have to go to war. And we have to play a major role in that. And right now, the 2nd Brigade of First ID is doing that in Africa, where we're trying to shape that environment. We're trying to build partner capacity so extremist organizations who are trying to establish safe havens there aren't able to do that. That's the kind of work we're going to see over the next several years. But we always must be ready in case we have to deploy forces in order to secure ourselves. I tell everyone that although we're coming out of two wars and we're reducing the size of the Army, this is probably the most uncertain I've seen our security environment in the 37 years I've been in the Army. And it's because of we have a new leader in North Korea who's very young, unpredictable. We worry about miscalculations. We have problems in Syria. I believe we'll probably have a new regime in Syria over the next year or so. What does that mean to the Middle East? There's nothing that happens independently in the Middle East. Everything affects everything else. So will we be able to maintain stability there? Will they need us there? We continue to have the nuclear issue with Iran. We have to watch very carefully. We want to build a security environment in the Asia Pacific that allows both us, China, and all the other nations in the Asia Pacific to continue to develop economically with no one overly dominating the area. So these are many things that are out there that we face today. And so we have to make sure that we continue to build an army that can be part of the joint force to support this. And the keys to that are globally responsive, regionally engaged. Regionally engaged means we will align forces to different regions to help to shape that environment. We'll be more predictable in how we do this. But to me, it's pretty exciting as we move forward. There's some other things we've done in the Army. We've just published a whole new set of doctrine for the first time in probably 30 years. And it's taking what we've learned over the last 10 or 12 years and then looking to the future and how we project that doctrine. And that's going to set the baseline for us as we move forward. So I think there's a lot of things going on, but there's a couple of things that I have to highlight that are problems I have to make everyone aware of. One is sexual harassment, sexual assault. There's many people who believe that we are unable to police our own ranks in terms of dealing with sexual harassment and sexual assault. We have to take this on head on. And the only way we can solve this is us in this theater, everyone. Soldiers, civilians, dependents, family members, working together to make sure we do not tolerate sexual harassment, sexual assault. It's going to take leaders at every level to get at this problem. It's unacceptable to me. It's outside of what we believe the profession is, the Army profession. It's outside of what we believe soldiers should be doing. We talk all the time about the importance of trust between soldiers and trust between soldiers and leaders. But if we have sexual harassment, sexual assault in our ranks, that eats at the very core of what we are about, trust. So we got to clean it up. And the only people who can do it are us. So we all need to get involved in this. We all need to work together to solve this problem. And I ask you to help me do that as we go forward. This is a great army we have. This is the best army in the world. Nobody disputes that. Anywhere you go, they will tell you this is the best army in the world. They've watched it over the last 12 years. They've seen us adapt. They've seen us operate. They've seen what we can do. And 2 years from now, we're going to be the best army in the world. And 5 years, we're going to be the best army in the world. But we got to constantly move forward. We got to constantly improve. We got to police ourselves. We are an institution that is respected. We want to keep it that way. And if we don't clean up sexual assault, sexual harassment, it's going to have an impact on that. And we can't allow that to happen. So I'm imploring all of you to help me solve this problem. I can't do it alone. We have 1.1 million soldiers in our Army today, active National Guard and U.S. Army Reserve. We have 260,000 civilians, and we have 1.4 million family members. I can't do it by myself. We all got to get involved with this, and we all got to work our way through it. I'm impressed with the programs that we have here at Fort Riley, but it's not about the development of programs, it's about the implementation of the programs. And it's about everybody being involved. So as I look ahead, I'm encouraged because we are at a position of strength because we have the most experienced combat-tested Army we've ever had. We have leaders and non-commissioned officers. We have Department of the Army civilians. We have officers that are experienced, that have worked hard over these last 12 years to ensure that we have the right capabilities, who've operated in combat, who've shown personal and physical courage. So I believe we can do anything we want. And one of the key pieces is our ability to continue to develop leaders. That's our strength, developing non-commissioned officers and officers. And we have the best developmental program in the world, but we got to keep adapting it, changing it, so we continue to have the best leaders as we move forward. So I'm encouraged. I think we have an opportunity. These are exciting times. We're coming out of two wars. We're going to be in a process of developing our army for the future. You can be involved with that. We need you to be involved in it as we go forward. So we got to work together to get us going in the right direction so we continue to be respected around the world. Again, I want to thank you for being here. It is an honor to be here at Fort Riley among the great soldiers and civilians and family members that are here. So with that, I want to open it up to questions. So who's going to ask the first question?
Sir, I'm honored to talk to you. My name is Larry Potter. I am a service officer throughout the American Legion and the BFW, and happen to be here with my district commander as well as district quartermaster. And we're having an issue, and it affects both of us.
Yeah.
We share everybody here. Whether we hold picnics on the 27th of August and they attend at the park, or once they leave you, and they become veterans that we need to take care of. I would also like to know what you do know about Fort Riley and base realignment, but I'd like to talk to you about a different issue. We have these folks. They are coming out, and they've been deployed multiple times, and some of them are developing PTSD. And yet, we're having discharges that might even say general. And we're having to deploy assets to get them waivered through VA, to get them the medical care and the education that they need so that they can still succeed. The bottom line on that is that as we have soldiers deploy more and more, and they do more and more, and we're proud of them all, I wish you all could see what it was like when I came out of Vietnam, especially even after my third tour. I want you to know you're loved. You are cared for. But we have to be able to take care of them too. Right now, we have about 12 states that actually even have a veterans court. In Kansas, we are very actively pursuing that immediately, even at this time, to create a veterans court here as well. That way, if you have discharged an individual for conduct that might potentially be related to PTSD, and if the prosecutor and the lawyer and the judge all agree, they will drop the charge and put it to a veterans court so that it's handled in kind of a more like a soldier on soldier method to bring them to cure. We want success too, and we know you want success. And if we could get, from your point of view going down, some leniency, more in the thought of defining bad character for those who have deployed and come back and they're not quite the same, because none of us are. And to try to keep it under honorable rather than less than honorable or even general, because you can't get them education until you work on them, help them, assist them. And it's even a little bit more deplorable when a veteran has completed their full minimum service obligation, and yet they're marked out as general. And one that was recent to my mind had deployed three times. And this is where I think you could be wonderfully instrumental. And I thank you very much, Commander.
Thank you. Thanks. Well, let me just comment a little bit. First, thank you for that. I really do appreciate it. Thank you very much. I appreciate your dedication to our soldiers. And, you know, what we're trying to do is learn from our mistakes. We had mistakes, obviously, coming out of Vietnam. We've had some mistakes as we come out of this fight as well. And we're trying to set up programs that allow our soldiers to better transition out of the Army. We've set up a Soldier for Life office that is dedicated to this subject, where we're trying to ensure that we transition soldiers properly out of the Army. And if they continue to need assistance, we get them transitioned to the Veterans Affairs and other organizations who can continue to help them. We also try to put this together to help them to decide whether they want to get a continuing education, or we even try to help them to get work. We're just starting on this. We've reinvested a lot of money into this because we understand, first, We don't want to have high unemployment among our veterans. We want them to, we think they're a valuable asset to the rest of the community, and we want them to be understood as that valuable asset. In terms of type of discharges, you know, it's important for our commanders at all levels to understand this and balance this. And we got to continue to make sure they have the balance to, you know, make sure they adjudicate appropriately those who do things that should be and those that maybe might be more related towards the effects of combat. And we continue to talk about this as we go through this. And we try to give them as many chances as possible to get into our system of behavior health to ensure we're getting them the help necessary. So we'll continue to work this, and you know, we can work with organizations like you represent to help us with this as well. And I think it's important we do that from my level at a national level and then from the local level reaching out so we have these good discussions. Because we don't want anybody slipping through the crack. Because if you've worn this uniform and you've deployed, you've served your country, and we want to try to take care of you the best way we can. And so I absolutely understand what you're saying, sir. Thank you very much.
So I have a question in regards to, and thank you for your service, by the way. I'm a vet, and I'm also understanding perspective from the spouse's point of view. But in regards to, as we mentioned, the Veterans Administration, the peer specialist positions that, because we have now developed some peer grouping for the Veterans Administration, particular peer specialists that are now being positioned into the VA right. system. And the if anybody wants to talk offline to me and you're a vet, I know there's a tight freeze with the federal government right now, but there's some opportunities if you are a vet. So if you want to get with me, I can hook you up with that. But what I was going to say is, you know, kudos for that we're actually trying to help those vets, because we are seeing that the statistics of soldiers with PTSD, and a lot of times they do become an issue, and so we're trying to get them out of the military. And sometimes there are underlying issues. I'm glad that the VA has started implementing those type of programs. In regards to that, the new program, I'm assuming you're shaking your head so you know everything that I'm talking about.
Yeah, keep going.
You probably helped to initiate some of that. So my question to you is that a pilot program? Is that funded only for a shortened period, for a trial period, or is that something that's going to be continuing?
Yeah, I think so. Thank you. Great question. So this program is one that it's a pilot, but we get assessments on it. And what we want to do is really, we think it's going to be a successful program, so we want to expand it. Working with the VA specifically to expand this program to make it easier for our veterans as they transition. So our goal is to expand the program, get feedback from it. Do we have it in the right places? Where do we put it? And our Surgeon General is working very closely with the VA on implementing this program. And we're trying to be very aggressive at it. Because one of the things we always worry about is the handoff between when you leave the Army and when you try to link up with Veterans Affairs. And this can help with this program as well. Both of those programs combined can be very effective. So it's a program we're very excited about. It's one that we're looking at, and I think so far the feedback, as you just presented, has been pretty good. So we're probably going to try to expand that a little bit more.
Good afternoon, sir. I'm Brenda Warner, and my question pertains to two things, kind of. One is the recent transition we've had with our dental and our medical, where we went from United Concordia to MetLife, and I think there was still struggling even after a period of time now. When you were under a treatment program under United Concordia, and then when MetLife picked up, big confusion as amount of how many benefits had already been paid out, and when they, you know, a lot of things back and forth there as far as if it's been overpaid or underpaid, and it ends up coming back onto the family member to pick up the difference. And then, of course, I mean, it's no secret the struggle families are having with their referrals. When we had the TRICARE system and United Health picked up, those that were seeking treatment or had recently been put in for a referral, the massive long delay on that. And I would kind of like to know what we're doing at an upper level to fix those issues.
Yeah, so I am not aware of the first issue you talked about, so I'll take that on and I'll get back with you. I am aware of the transition from TriWest to United Healthcare, right? That has been brought to our attention. The Surgeon General is looking very, first it's a contract, so they participated for a contract. United Health won the contract. Now we have to make sure that they are meeting the requirements of the contract, and that's what we're taking a look at now, but also seeing where we can supplement until they get fully stood up. This has been coming up, TriWest, which is most of the western United States, this has come up quite regularly, so it's clearly a huge issue that we are very aware of, and we're working our way through it. I know that's not a satisfactory answer for you, but we are working our way through this. We understand there's a problem. We understand there's been a significant change in service. We're trying to get to the bottom of it, and we're trying to work through both contracting means and through the Surgeon General on how we can help to manage this and make it better as we go forward. So I guess what I would tell you is we are aware of this, we are working it, and we'll get back to you on the things we're doing, okay? Yeah. Go ahead. I'll get you next.
Hello, sir. My name is Casey Skerlock. I heard that there was going to be a $3,000 a year cut from veterans' pay.
No, I don't know anything about that. There's no, as far as I know, there's no cut in pay.
Okay.
There's been no reduction in pay. In fact, we continue to have, actually continues to go up. So there's been no cut. Asked for, no cut considered. So I think that's just a rumor. Right here.
So you had mentioned that future budget cuts could create some modernization concerns.
Yeah.
So I was wondering, in your mind, which part of our organization is in greatest need of restructuring, modernization for the future generations?
So let me talk to you about, there's this kind of a complex thing. So there's four things that really define our budget. It's your end strength, it's your readiness, which is training readiness, material readiness, family readiness, it's modernization, and then there's compensation. So all of those are the four major elements of our budget. As I stand here today, 45% of the Army budget is based on the cost of soldiers. So that's almost half of our budget. So because of the way the cuts are coming, we cannot take soldiers out as fast as the as big as the cuts are, because it doesn't make sense. In fact, because we have to pay them benefits if we take more soldiers out, and we end up not saving any money. So unfortunately, what that means is we have to take more money out of readiness and modernization. So what that means is right now we haven't canceled any modernization programs, but we have stretched them. So instead of being ready in 8 years, it's now 10 years. So what that means is our ability to provide more modern equipment is being extended further and further down. And there's going to come a time here, if we get more budget cuts, where we're going to have to just cut some modernization programs. Our priorities for modernization are the soldier. So we will continue to focus on making sure our soldiers are equipped and protected, that they have the IT capabilities to get the most current information as fast as possible, both intelligence and current operations capabilities, and that they have the mobility to move around the battlefield, whether you're light, medium, or heavy. Those are our priorities. And we'll continue to focus on those priorities as we move forward in the modernization sense. So my concern is you got to keep those in balance. And right now, I think we're going to be out of balance for the next 3 years, and that's a concern to me. And what's going to cost is our readiness, and that's what worries me. And that's what I'm trying to fix that problem over the next couple years. That's what I'm focused on.
Quick question. You spoke to readiness, and one of the best ways that we can maintain our readiness is to retain our best troopers and soldiers in our units. With the downsizing that's coming, has there been any thought in changing how we do retention so that we don't potentially lose some of our best guys because they're all in the same year?
Well, what I've done is we're trying to give as much flexibility down to the brigade commanders as possible when it comes to retention. We started that policy last year where they get to decide who and when. And I've taken off the requirements to say you got to meet certain goals during certain times because I want to be able to extend the amount of flexibility. So we are going to continue to do that as we go forward because we do want to keep the best soldiers. And the commanders are the ones who understand who the best soldiers are better than us. So I don't want to manage it high Department of the Army level. I want to give the brigade commanders as much flexibility as possible when it comes to this. And they then set a standard and decide who gets to reenlist and who doesn't as we go forward.
Yeah. Sir, Corporal Laney, 1st Brigade, 44 Cav.
You're talking about combat readiness and the budget affecting that. Can you specify any plans in particular to increase combat effectiveness and readiness, sir?
Say that again.
Can you specify on any plans you have to increase combat effectiveness?
Well, so first off, the first thing we have to do, if they reduce our budget, what we have to do is reduce the size of the Army. Now, if we reduce the size of the Army, we'll have fewer brigades, but we'll make sure they're mostly modern and ready. The other thing we have to do is a couple things. We have to make better use of what I call the live, virtual, constructive capabilities we have. We go out and do a mixture of live training, virtual training with the simulators we have, and then as you get to higher levels, more constructive, where you can build units together to practice, you know, on computer and other exercises. So it's we have to get more effective and efficient at our training and making all the use out of our dollars. And some of that has to do with not moving people around so much, so you can maintain crew proficiency, platoon proficiency. It's about making the best use of our combat training centers, that when you go there, they become a certification platform which certifies our brigades and our battalions and does it in a more efficient and effective way. I think there's ways we can do that. So there's all those kind of things that we're taking a look at. And I think we're going to be able to do this. It's just a matter, we're going to have some rough periods here. What I'm trying to explain to everybody is going to be a rough period probably for the next year or so. But we're going to set ourselves up where we can get into this period where we'll be able to do good, solid training and ensure that we have the highest readiness possible that gives us the capability to do whatever we need to do no matter where we're sent.
Sir, I'm Specialist Aaron Duncan with 44 Cav, 1 Armored Brigade Combat Team. A few months back, those of us who are in school know that tuition assistance kind of went on hiatus for a little bit.
Yeah.
It's been weighing on my mind, sir, because as someone with kids, I look forward to being able to give my GI Bill to my kids. And I've been told, well, you can dip into your GI Bill to pay for college. But for those of us who plan on passing on to someone else and would like to utilize tuition assistance, where do you see that going in the future as part of the reduction in funds and as far as it affecting the overall readiness? Because as a medic, I look forward to progressing my career and my ability to provide for the other men and women who are in uniform in this room today if the need arises. And how do we keep going forward, sir, with the thought of that looming on our minds? Because some of us were in the middle of classes and they said, oh, sorry, we're not going to be able to provide classes for you anymore.
Okay. So tuition assistance is going to continue. For this year, let me explain what happened. So we allocated $330 million for tuition assistance. We ran out of money. So we are now at about $420 million spent on tuition assistance this year. The Army has the most liberal tuition assistance program among any of the services. So we're going to continue doing tuition assistance, but that extra $90 million I just talked about had to come from somewhere else. So I got to balance all that. So what we have to do is review the tuition assistance program where we will continue to have it and then do it in such a way that is the most cost-efficient and effective way to do it. So there's several proposals we're looking at. Some say we'll pay 75%, not 100% of tuition assistance. That's one option. That would save us some money. It also might cause the schools to lower their costs, actually, if we did that. So, you know, or we say you can do so much during your first term, and then when you reenlist, it becomes unlimited how you do tuition assistance. That's another thing we're taking a look at. So we're not going to eliminate it, but we're going to change the parameters a little bit. But you're still going to have the opportunity to use tuition assistance to improve yourself. That's why we have it. We want our soldiers to improve themselves individually, because that's benefit to us when you do that, not only to yourself. But we have to figure out a better way to do this where everyone can still take advantage of it, but it doesn't cost as much money as it's costing us right now, and that's what we're looking at. So this summer, we'll probably come out with a new tuition assistance policy, but it will not end. We'll continue to have it, and I think you'll find it to work pretty well, actually, in the end.
Thank you, sir.
Yeah.
First Sergeant Kraft, sir.
Hey, First Sergeant, how you doing?
My question ties in a lot of what you've already touched on as far as readiness, as far as finances, as far as taking care of soldiers. I know that we at the lower levels, and I'm quite sure I speak for every soldier in the Army, one of the things that we're dealing with is the effects of polypharmacy. Soldiers who have PTSD and other issues, and they are on unlimited number of meds. I recently talked to a young soldier who was on 14 different meds. And that worries me. It generally concerns me for the future of our Army, and especially for the younger soldiers. What are you at the higher levels doing to affect that?
So there's a couple of things that we've done. There's two separate programs that we have. One is we have a pain management policy within our hospitals that are starting to deal with alternative ways to deal with pain management. And there are things like meditation, there's things like yoga, there's things like other activities that have been proven in other medical areas that lessens pain and doesn't require as much medicine. So we're continuing to work that piece. With polypharmacy, which are what I call, in some cases, it's too many prescription drugs, and in some cases, it's abuse of prescription drugs. We now have a policy that if you have over five or more medications, you go into a special monitoring program at the hospitals to make sure that we're looking at, are these the right meds? How do they interact with each other? Do you need all of these? And part of the problem we have, though, is soldiers will go get medication from the hospital here, then they go see a doctor downtown and get medication, then go see a doctor over here, and we have trouble tracking how many meds are on because the doctors keep giving them different medications, but we're trying to now come up with how we can understand that and then start to deal with this problem, because it is a problem. So I think the good start is when you're at five meds, we're now looking at very carefully your records, we're working with you, we're supposed to be working with the individuals in order to figure out how we reduce that medication, and are they all appropriate or not, and are there alternative methods to help you as you move forward, because there's no way you can stay on that many meds over a long period of time, especially when there's psychotropic drugs involved. And so this is a policy we put in place about 3 months ago. So it'll take its time to get fully implemented, but we're in the process of implementing that now. It's a great question, First Sergeant. Thanks for asking it. Yeah.
Good afternoon, sir. Sergeant First Class Swiney, Irwin Army, Department of Pathology. Thank you for coming. I have to ask this question because transition. You said we're going to move soldiers around less. I've got soldiers concerned about the movement. Are we looking at the homestead program where they stay 4 years or more, or are we still going to be doing 3 years or less?
Yeah, it depends on who you're talking about. So, as you become a senior non-commissioned officer and an officer, it becomes a little bit more difficult if you want to progress professionally. So what we then, we move you in order to professionally give you the jobs necessary for you to stay competitive and continue to get promoted. And that might be impossible to do at one installation. So for more senior NCOs and officers, I would argue that you'll probably move at 3 years. What we're trying to do is first, especially initial enlistees and maybe sergeants, staff sergeants, it's easier for us to leave them in one place longer. And we're certainly taking a look at that as we move away from R4Gen. Now, we have to wait till we get more people out of Afghanistan. And so at the end of 14, we're going to be able to more fully implement a policy of leaving people longer at installations. So it really depends on on your rank. You know, because if we, in some cases, if we leave you in the same place, it won't help you professionally. And we gotta balance that against being able to stay in. But if you say, but my guess is if you wanna, you know, say if you wanna stay here and go to another assignment and then come back, I think that will be easy to do, depending on the size of the installation. In a place like Fort Riley, it should be fairly easy to do if that's what you wanna do. Anybody else? Yeah.
Chaplain Ferris, work with United States Army Garrison here at Fort Riley. I'd be curious to hear what gets you up in the morning, what drives you personally to do what you do, and what is your singular hope for the Army family?
Well, what drives me every day is the great soldiers that we have. I mean, you know, the reason you do this for 37 years is because of the great people you get to deal with. I've gotten to witness amazing things in my career. Amazing accomplishments, whether it's in garrison or in war. Incredible courage, incredible talent, incredible camaraderie that I'll never forget. And so that's what gets me up every day. It's about understanding the sacrifice of our soldiers and our families, and that I'll do all I can to ensure that we continue to honor that sacrifice. Yes, we have problems. Yes, we everything's not perfect, but we're going to work every day to make sure that we do the best for our soldiers and families, and our Department of the Army civilians, by the way, who are dedicated to us. And that's what drives me every single day. You know, having the opportunity to serve multiple tours in combat has given me the opportunity to watch young men and women perform superbly under incredibly stressful conditions, and perform superbly. And the fact that they are willing to raise their right hand in a time of war and say, I want to support the Constitution of the United States, that drives me every single day. And then I watch the family members as I go around installations and how they dedicate themselves to their soldiers, to their families, to their friends, and how we come together as a community. That's very rare in many places. And that's why I've always said I have two families. I have my biological family and my Army family. And they both mean a lot to Linda and I as we've grown up here in the Army. So that's what drives me every day. Thanks for that question, Chaplain. You know, why you said that, you know, I know there's a chapel named here, Capon Chapel. And we had the opportunity and he's from Kansas, he's right from this area. We had the opportunity to finally award him the Medal of Honor for his service in Korea. This is the most incredible story that I've ever heard of bravery and courage without ever carrying a weapon. The number of lives he saved in Korea was absolutely incredible. Through his strength of character, through his strength of spiritual strength, and his love of his fellow soldier. And it's a great story, and I hope you have an opportunity to understand, since he came from this area, right around this area. And I'm very proud that they have a chapel named, and actually, he's been nominated for sainthood in the Catholic Church as well. Really an incredible individual. So anyhow, thanks for the question. Anybody else? I thought somebody back here. Yeah.
Also, Specialist Hurdle, 977 MP Company. I have a quick question. With big Army doing cutbacks and whatnot as supply, it seems like we are getting the short end of the stick when we're trying to facilitate our own. What's your plans about being able to facilitate our soldiers in this time of great uncertainty, sir?
Yeah. So what I tell our soldiers during this time is that I will tell you that if you do your job, you work hard, that there's room for you in this Army. If you want to get out of the Army, we're going to help and assist you to get out of the Army and help you transition so you can transition into the civilian community. That's what I'm trying to establish. Because we appreciate your service. So I think there's still lots of opportunity out there. And I think that there's room for everyone to continue to serve as we move forward. Yes, there's going to be some competition as we do it, and we'll work through our way through that. But in my mind, if you want to continue to serve, you're working hard, you're doing your job, there'll be room for you. If you choose to get out and do something else, we're going to help you transition and do that as well.
Sir, thank you for coming. My name is Melanie Gill, and I work for ACAP. I want to personally thank you for the improvement of the program. If you guys don't know what ACAP is, it's an Army Career Alumni Program. It is there to assist you guys with your transition. I personally am a veteran after 14 years. My husband and son both are field artillery. So I personally have invested my heart and soul into the program, and I know you have as well, sir. You yourself personally have signed off on the act, and there's a lot of money that is vested as taxpayers as well into making sure the soldiers and their families are taken care of once they are preparing for their transition. With that being said, to the gentleman that asked the first question, doesn't matter regardless of the transition status, the soldier is afforded the opportunity to ACAP. All of our placements, my ratio is 80 to 90% of my soldiers do get direct placement for employment if they've gone through all the process. With the recent VOW Act, they've had 90% job placement. So with your guarantee of the program, I wanted to personally thank you that it is working and it is putting the soldiers to work.
Yeah, thanks. What she's talking about is we asked, and President Obama approved in November of 11, the VOW Act, which significantly increased investment in Army transition services, and it went into effect in November of 12. So it's been in effect place about 4 months now. And we've actually seen great results from it, and I thank you for pointing out how it's working here. And that's what I was talking about when I mentioned that, is that we feel that is part of strongly about our responsibility. Because, you know, I have a kinship to anybody who served. You know, I don't care when you served, but if you served, we have a special kinship. And I always talk about how we stand on the shoulders of those who came before us. For those who sacrificed, who served our nation, we stand on their shoulders. And we have people that come after us who have to stand on our shoulders. And part of that is helping our soldiers transition. So they can go into the, if they decide to leave the Army, so they can go into our communities and talk about their service and how much it meant to them and how they can continue to serve outside of that and improve this country, like you're doing, by the work that you're trying to do here. And to me, that's really important as we go forward. So thanks.
We have time for one or two more questions before we're going to recognize.
I got two hands up. I got three. I'll do three. I'll do this one and these two. I got somebody in the back and then these two right here.
How you doing, sir? My name is Gabriel Estes. I work in the Integrated Disability Evaluation System here at Fort Riley. And the question I'd like to ask in regards to recent Army Times postings and things is we're trying to, you know, cut down our force, obviously. One of the most efficient ways we can do that now is through the Integrated Disability Evaluation System to transition out those soldiers that are no longer medically capable of doing the job they were intended to do, thereby giving commanders, obviously, medically fit soldiers to do the jobs that they need. One of the things I have seen in the last couple of years working here is that a soldier, regardless of his previous service, when integrated into the system, loses any previous accomplishments to a sense and becomes now an MEB soldier and somebody who takes up a slot on a triple alpha 162. And the other part of my question is regards to the Army's focus on toxic leadership and the treatment of soldiers, and kind of what is the plan from Big Army to balance those two issues out?
Yeah, thanks. Well, first, there's a fine line we walk whenever we talk about, you know, we want to transition soldiers through the disability system as quickly as it takes for them to be taken care of and also leave the Army. And there's a fine line you walk there. You know, it was taking us like 2 years to when it shouldn't have. And what was happening is people were waiting on administrative pieces. So we want to eliminate that. But we also want to make sure that they continue to get the care that they need, whether it's before they leave or after they leave. And that's part of this. And we have to be careful about that. And I know there's also a thing about, you know, we can't be too harsh in ensuring we want to get them out so we can get the next soldier in, because we owe it to them to take care of them. And so that's a fine line that we have to walk. And the second question you asked, which was a good one, actually.
That was about how toxic
leaders. Yeah, toxic leaders. Yeah, so there's several things that we're working. So first off, we have changed, we're developing how we are training leaders and assessing leaders. We're inputting 360 assessments. We're now starting it for all new officers that come in to do this, and we're also, I'm doing a pilot right now for battalion and brigade commanders. And it's about them getting feedback into their leadership styles and how effective they are. And we're going to work through that, and then we're going to determine how we use that information in order to either change their behavior, or if they won't change their behavior, then to, you know, remove them. But so I don't mean it to be harsh, but it's important that we understand that we're not going to tolerate toxic leaders. And there's different definitions of toxic leaders, by the way. There's ones that are abusive, that's one set. And then there's another set of toxic leaders who don't make decisions and refuse to make decisions and put their soldiers at risk and other people at risk. And that's a form of toxic leadership. So it's a combination of things that we're taking a look at. Leadership is not a popularity contest. And I'll never, you know, that's not what this is about. It's just about treating people with dignity and respect, maintaining high standards, and implementing standards fair, firm but fair, and evenly across your formation. And we expect leaders to lead out from the front, lead in combat, lead in garrison, and that's what we expect. And we're going to continue to figure out ways to continue to evaluate this, adjust behaviors, and we're working this very, very hard. So thank you for the question. Over here, somebody had a question.
Sir, Staff Sergeant Wyma, 5-4 Cav. With all MOSs being open to all types of soldiers, I'm wondering if there's any kind of plan to standardize the physical expectations of soldiers instead of this soldier only has to do this much physical activity, this right. soldier has to do less, even though they're expected right. to do right. the same amount of physical.
Right. So what we're doing is, what we're talking about is we're opening up We're looking at how we open up combat specialties to women. So what we're doing is a TRADOC is doing a study which will take about 2 years. That first is developing common standards, and it'll be standards for MOSs regardless of gender. And we're doing that now. That'll take us about a year or so to develop. And then we're looking at how we integrate and what it would take to integrate women in. And so we expect over about a 2-year period, we will come out with a plan and program that establishes common standards. There won't be two standards. There will be one standard for everybody. And if you meet the standards, then we'll move you into that formation. So we're in the process of working that. We're going through it. We have outside health organizations, we have testing organizations helping us to develop these standards. Because this is about, so this is how I view this. It's about, I have to manage talent in the Army. I need to get the best out of all our talent. And so I want to take the best people who are fitted for the best job and set them up for success, and that's what we're going to do. But we're going to do this right. We're not going to rush to failure. We're going to do this in a way where it gives women the chance to be integrated properly, and it also does not set different standards for different people to operate in MOS, and that's where we're headed. Thank you. Great question. There's somebody over here. Yeah.
Sergeant Post, DHSBGT.
Yeah.
Recently, the division sent a team out to D.C. to join a debate about D6.
Yeah.
I've seen your debates against Congress.
Yeah.
What's your take on the program, and do you see it staying and going?
Thanks. Well, the program's going to stay. It's an interesting, so DSIGS-A is a program that enables us for the first time to integrate intelligence from the national level all the way down to company level. It enables us to integrate all the different ints, SIGINT, MASINT, ELINT, all the other ints that are out there. We've never been able to do that before. There's some other capabilities that are really good in niche capabilities. So what we want to do is we want to be able to integrate the best technology as we move forward into D6A. So DCSA will continue as a program, but we'll continue to integrate the best technologies that continue to improve DCSA as we move forward. And that's what we're planning on doing. But I'm very confident the program will continue. Great question. Okay, this is the last question. Go ahead. It's the only reason I did this because you raised it so quickly and you were very, so go ahead.
Sir, I see you, we are the same uniform. So do you do the PT every day?
Yes, PT, yes.
What's your last the PT score?
340, no, I'm just kidding. About 270.
Already?
But I'm old, so it's a lot easier. The older you get, the easier it gets. They cut us some slack. Great question. So nobody asked me about the uniform. Do you want to know about the uniform? Everybody always asks me about that. All right, so there's this. Are we going to change this uniform? Yes. But it's going to be done over time. Why are we changing it? Because we have found it not to be the right uniform for us to use in combat. So it'll probably be a couple years before it changes. It won't cost the Army any more money to do it because we're going to wait till these are all used up. And when these are all used up, we'll bring in the new pattern and we'll announce that here pretty soon. Okay? So I've done about 6 of these sessions. This is the best one I have done. The best one. And the reason is I got asked great questions from a variety of different people. And so it was really good. So thank you for that. Thank you for asking me those. That's what I want. That's why I do these. I want you to ask me hard questions. So thanks a lot. I appreciate everything you do. And Army strong. Thank you very much.